That leads to our final case, which is 2022-62 Cup Computing AS versus Trend Micro, Inc. Mr. Andre.
May it please the court. I'm going to focus my argument on the claim construction issue that was front center in the briefing, and that in which the PTAB has taken an interest in as well. PTAB construed a mobile security system that could be a part of the remote device, a mobile device. It says it can be one and the same, mobile device, mobile security system. A plain reading of the claims dictate otherwise. Not only to one skill in the art, but also to just the common use of the English language. And I direct your attention to Claim 10 of the 488 patent. This is on this is the representative claim that all the parties used in this briefing. What's claimed is a mobile security system that A, has its own processor, B, has a connection mechanism for connecting to a data port of a mobile device. Now, that's connecting to a mobile device. That right there tells you it's not one and the same. A mobile security system is not part of the mobile device, so why would it have a data port to connect to it? And then for communicating with the mobile device, once again, not only is it connecting to a mobile device, but communicating with it. The board said the mobile security system can be part of the mobile device. That makes no sense, no common sense, and a complete misreading of the English language.
So then why does the specification also say an embodiment of the present invention involves a mobile security system that may be incorporated within the mobile device?
Yeah, in the specification, and I direct your honor's attention to the sentence just before that. This is at column 8. It says the mobile security system 3, 4, 5 may be in a pocket size, handheld size, or key size housing, or possibly smaller. Further, the mobile security system may be incorporated within the mobile device. The way I read that is they're talking about a thumb drive, a keychain, something you put into it, and it can be incorporated within. Factually, that's how I would read that sentence. But nonetheless, under this case, the court's precedent of Rolls-Royce, Novo Nordisk, Johnson & Johnson, you can't discount the language of the actual claims to bring in a preferred embodiment if the claims just don't support it.
Right, but if your argument is no reasonable person, no person of skill in the art, no one who understands English would ever think that these things were not separate, your own patentee tells us right there in the portion I read you they could be separate.
Well, when it says it could be incorporated within the mobile device, that to me, I say it's an alternative reading. The way I read it was because right before they talked about thumb drives, and the patent talked about thumb drives, taking a drive, a mobile security system, and plugging it into a laptop, which is not uncommon, would be incorporating within the mobile device. It's just an alternative reading. So even if the board would read the specification in that light, you don't. If the claims just don't support that preferred embodiment, this court has said multiple times, you don't get the preferred embodiment. I mean, it's not uncommon for people to ask for broad specifications, broad disclosures. When they write the claims, they write it much more narrowly. And in this particular instance, it goes on in the claim when it talks about the security engine. The security engine, which is part of the mobile security system. It says detects using the mobile security system a process, a wake event. So the system has to detect a wake event. If the system is asleep on power saving mode, it couldn't detect it. It's not possible. Once again, the use of the English language. And this is the protective wake, having a mobile device processor different than the mobile security system processor. Now, they're very explicit here. The mobile device processor is different than the mobile security system processor. They're different processors. And then it's adapted to wake at least a portion of the mobile device. Once again, if it's part of the mobile device, how's it going to wake the mobile device? It makes no sense whatsoever. Throughout the entire specification, with the exception Your Honor pointed out, every drawing, every figure, every description of it, and throughout the entire specification, describes it as two separate components, two separate devices. They're not one in the same. The one section in the specification that does give that ambiguous language, I think it's ambiguous anyway, because I read it differently than the board read it, would be a broader disclosure, but not necessarily in line with the claims. The claims themselves then talk about how the mobile security system is going to manage the security services configured to protect the mobile device. Once again, if they're one and the same, this doesn't make sense. The intrinsic record here is replete with this very construction that we would propose that the board reject, and this is a controlling construction. Now, the specification and the claims give us a good reading, but now this is the prosecution history, furthers that. During original prosecution, the PTO found the claims obvious over a two pieces of prior art, Grant and Priestley. The examiner found Grant did not teach mobile security system processors different from mobile device processors, but Priestley filled that hole. The patentee overcame that reference by arguing that the alleged mobile security system in Priestley is part of the mobile device. It is part of the mobile device. Then the processor would not be different than the mobile device processor. That's how the claim was allowed. That's about as an express disclaimer as you can get. That's a disavow of claim scope where you'd have the two processors, mobile security system and a mobile device processor, on the same unit. They're different. They're in different places. Now, this court has determined that during these IPR processes, this is in the ALIS case, during the IPR process, you can also have prosecution history disclaimer. So during the IPR process, we want to make it very clear. We said, we think it's very clear in the original prosecution, there is a disclaimer. But let's just make it explicit as can be. We said, we explicitly disavow the claim scope that the PTAB was going to give us. We'll narrow the claims to this term that they say was different than the mobile processor. We're going to disavow that they reside in the same place. Now, at that point, this should be done. The claim instruction should be done. But the PTAB said, no, we're not going to accept your disavow.
So if someone in a district court infringement case makes a disavow, is that binding on the district court?
If they do a disavow, I don't know if they can change claims for a district court because you're interpreting under Phillips. But because the prosecution is done at that point. So the answer is no. I don't know the answer to that. I've never seen a case where you can change the claim scope in district court. But I have seen a case now where you can change the claim scope in IPR.
For purposes of the IPR itself.
What's that?
Not for purposes of the IPR itself.
Well, I think the ALIS case does indicate that you could change for that. That is a prosecution. Yeah.
That indicates you could change it for the IPR proceeding itself?
No, if there's a disavow in the IPR process.
It's binding in later district court.
Right.
But it doesn't say it's binding in the IPR.
Well, it's silent to that, but it makes sense. If it's binding on the patentee in district court, why would it not be binding at the IPR process as well?
On the board.
Yeah, but if it's a term that is ambiguous, by the board's definition, and you say to resolve this ambiguity, like this claim I don't think is ambiguous read in light of the entire claim, but if it was ambiguous, the one specific term would have differences.
I'm just pointing out that there's a difference between binding on the one who's doing disclaiming and binding on somebody else.
No, I don't think
like it's the adjudicator or the other side.
I don't think it's binding on the board, but what is the board's interest in not accepting that disclaimer, just like, as it is in, you know, as this court found,
forcing you into the amendment process as the solution for a recognized problem with the originally issued claims.
Well, it is.
Didn't the board say that?
Well, that's what the board says in its briefing, that we should go through an amendment process as opposed to an argument process. This court found in Standard Oil that you could either do a prosecution disclaimer through amendment or argument. So I don't think that's binding. The only case that the board cites is the Tempo Lighting case, and that case was an original prosecution. And during the original prosecution, the broadest reasonable interpretation applied. Phillips was not applied on that interpretation. So that's explicit in the Tempo case. So I think at this point, when you go into a proceeding like an IPR, and if you read the claims in its totality, it's clear on the plain reading of the claims that these are meant to be on two separate components, remote and separate from each other, these two processors. And then the board is saying that the original disavow and the original prosecution was not as clear as it should be. That's what the board said, so we made it very clear. I think that is serving the purpose of the whole disavow body of case law, where it is to give the public notice. So in this particular instance, by adding into the claim language themselves, a very explicit language, it says that the mobile device having a mobile device processor different than the mobile security system processor. I don't know how much more explicit that could be in the claim language. The mobile device having a mobile device processor different than a mobile security system processor. Two different processors, not on the same device. If it's one processor on the device, they both be called the mobile device processor. But just the language before that, where it says communicating the data port to communicate with the mobile device. It's not a subsystem communicating with the mobile device processor. It's communicating with the mobile device. Sending communications to the mobile device, not the mobile device processor, the mobile device. You're sending it to that. It has to be outside the mobile device to send it a communication to the mobile device. You wouldn't send it to yourself. That makes no sense at all. Once again, common sense and plain language. So going back to the prosecution history disclaimer, I think in this particular instance, there was a prosecution history disclaimer, an original prosecution, and at the IPR process, to make it even more explicit, because that was an issue, I think that just reinforces what the disclaimer is about, and also allows for the public notice provision that this is meant to solve. I'll reserve the rest of my 3 minutes.
You agree there's nothing left to your Arthrex argument?
We'll submit on papers on Arthrex, Your Honor. But
you
I don't
didn't
think,
answer my question.
No, I don't think there's nothing left, Your Honor.
There's nothing left. Right?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. All right, thank you. Thank you. Mr. Bergey.
Thank you, Your Honors. As an initial matter, CUP counsel started his argument by saying that the board found that the security system can be one and the same as the mobile device. That's not correct, and Trend Micro doesn't set forth that argument. Instead, what the board found was that the security system can be part of the mobile device, a subsystem in the mobile device, or a subpart of the mobile device. And that conclusion is correct. It's supported by the claims and the specification. As Your Honors noted, the specification...
Don't start with the specification. He knows that that's a problem. The question he says, your friend on the other side says, notwithstanding the specification, you can't possibly do this under the claim language. Address the claim language.
The claim language is entirely consistent with the specification, and the claim language never says or even implies that the security system and mobile device have to be separate and remote, which is CUP's proposed construction. All the claim language says is that the two things have two different processors.
Maybe I've misremembered what was said. I thought that the argument was how do you square this notion that you and the board are relying on with the idea that one thing is connecting to the other, one thing is communicating with the other, one thing is detecting sleep or wakefulness on the other. Account for those pieces of the claim.
All of those things make sense in the case where the security system is part of the mobile device. I'll walk through them one at a time. If we start with the word connecting, if you imagine a security system that's within a mobile device, and again, each has its own processor, the security system subsystem can and must connect to the mobile device. They would connect via an internal mechanism, some bus or communication path between the two processors would be the simplest example.
I understand how it could connect with another component of the device. How exactly does it connect with the device of which it is a part?
Exactly how Your Honor said, which is connecting to a component of that device. Most naturally, the processor of the mobile device. If the two processors are connected, then the security subsystem is connected to the larger surrounding mobile device.
You don't think there's something odd about the language, and the same point would be about this communication that is a component of a device communicates with the device of which it is a component?
I don't. I agree with the board that that language is, makes sense in the case where the security system is a subpart of the mobile device. If we assume that there's the connection, then the communication over that connection makes sense. The two processors would communicate with each other. And CUP Council also pointed to the data port part of Claim 10. There are plenty of reasons why the data port makes sense if the security system is a subpart of the mobile device.
I see. So the connection language is not actually connecting to the device. It's connecting to a data port of the device.
Correct.
There's nothing problematic about that, of having one component connect to another, namely the data port, right?
Correct.
What about the communicating? But the communicating is with the device itself.
The communicating is with the device, and when the security system is part of the mobile device.
It means the processor, right? It means the mobile device processor.
It means the mobile device processor, yes, or some other part of the mobile device. The most natural case is the mobile device processor, or communicating with the data port of the mobile device, which could be internal. We know for many reasons that the data port can be internal. Figure 5 of the patent describes ports 505 and says they can exist within the mobile security system. It uses that word within. That's cited in our briefs, and that's at Appendix 365. So the specification says the ports can be within the mobile device, meaning it can be internal. There also is extrinsic evidence cited in our briefs describing that data ports can be internal in a variety of different ways. The specification also refers to external device ports in various places, suggesting that the phrase device port by itself is not necessarily external. And CUP's own expert, Dr. Medvedevich, testified what a data port means in deposition. And in his definition, he didn't say it has to be external at all. And his definition is cited in our brief. So we know the data port can be internal. And if we assume that the data port is internal, which it can be, then the connection to the data port can be internal too, and the communication over that connection can be internal as well. So all of those things make sense under Trend Micro's interpretation of this limitation and the board's interpretation of the limitation. At a minimum, none of those things rise to the level of highly persuasive evidence, which is what's required to exclude the embodiment in the specification. And CUP Council, I think, said that there was just one embodiment in the specification. That's not right. There are two embodiments in the specification that say the security system can be a subpart of the mobile device. One, Your Honors, read into the record. The other is cited in our briefs, which also is at Appendix 371, and it explains that the security system may reside in a digital device. And on the same page, the specification says
what,
that.
What column and line number?
This is in two separate excerpts, so starting at column 19, line 64. We're looking at Appendix 371, which is the 488 patent. This also is cited in our briefs. And at that line, it says, mobile security system 1702 may reside in a digital device. And then if we keep that passage in mind and jump over to column 20, line 49, it says that the mobile device is an example of a digital device. So if we put those two things together, the specification is saying in the second place that the security system may reside in a mobile device. And that's not surprising because the specification said it again in the earlier place that Your Honors read.
So, and that earlier place is the sentence, am I remembering, that says further the mobile security system may be incorporated within the mobile device?
Exactly, which is at Appendix 365 at column 8, line 13.
Can you address, the prosecution history, not what was said in the IPR, but in the original prosecution history, which the board said, here's some few sentences by which the applicant distinguished Priestley. They are uncertain in what those sentences say. Can you explain what the uncertainty there is?
The uncertainty arises from a few things. One is that in distinguishing Priestley, the applicant, Cup, never used the word separate and never used the word remote. And Cup's proposed construction here of this limitation is that the security system has to be, quote, separate and remote, end quote, from the mobile device. But it never used those words in distinguishing Priestley. And setting aside the specific words, Cup never expressly said that the two things, the security system and the mobile device, have to be separate and remote. It didn't say that using other words. It just didn't say that. It was distinguishing Priestley based on the lack of two different processors. And we know that perhaps most clearly by looking at the last sentence of the excerpt in the party's briefs, where Cup summarizes its arguments, and it says effectively, therefore, Priestley doesn't disclose two separate processors. Cup doesn't say, therefore, Priestley doesn't disclose two devices that are separate and remote from each other. In addition, the logic underlying Cup's statements about Priestley can be interpreted in multiple ways. Cup seems to be inferring that there was some assumption underlying those statements, but there are other logic and other interpretations that could have served the basis of Cup's statements. In other words, those statements are open to multiple interpretations. They are ambiguous, and as a matter of law, because they're ambiguous, they're not a clear and unequivocal statement needed for prosecution disclaimer. We set forth some of those interpretations in our brief. So, to summarize, there just isn't a clear and unmistakable disavowal in the statements about Priestley. At a minimum, they're open to interpretation, multiple interpretations.
On the issue of whether there could be a disclaimer during IPR that is binding during the IPR, do you argue against it on the grounds that you don't have adequate notice, or that the public notice function of claim scope is somehow undermined if that, you know, practice were to be permitted? Because as the patentee points out, they could go through the amendment process, and so is there a materially different amount of public notice to the amendment process than what they're trying to do here?
If we're talking about the public as the public excluding the party involved in the IPR itself, the other public, if you will, and we're talking about the public just viewing the IPR, no, because the public will see what happened after the IPR is done either way. Our objection to the notion that Cup statements in the IPR can be binding on the PTO is that, first, it's not based in the law. Second, it would cause chaos by allowing any patent owner to apply any narrowing construction to any claim term just by invoking some magic words. And third, it would completely obviate the amendment process, which, as Your Honor's pointed out, is the proper solution to the problem of patentees wanting to narrow their claims in IPR.
What's the difference in consequence between what they think should be done based on their disclaimer theory and what you agree could be done through the amendment process?
One practical consequence is the board can reject their request for amendment for various reasons, if it's not supported in the specification or for other procedural reasons. What Cup proposes is that it has some type of superpower where the board cannot reject its de facto amendment, if you will, because CUP proposes that all it has to do is invoke some words, and that narrowing construction is automatically binding on the board, and the board cannot reject that narrowing construction.
I think counsel today at least said it's not binding on the board. That may be a new position, but any comment on that?
I think that is a new position, and I don't understand what the effect of the statements in the IPR are. I think in the briefs anyway, their position is our statements are binding on the board. That was the entire reason it was making those statements, to try to say this is what this claim means. We disclaim anything else. Therefore, the prior art can't.
What it would mean is any time there's a challenge in IPR to a patent, all you need to do is to amend, to disclaim something which is found in the prior art, which is here at the patent.
Exactly right. It would almost eliminate any value of the entire IPR process, because all a savvy patent owner would have to do is say, I disclaim the very narrow disclosure of the prior art and nothing else. Therefore, that prior art doesn't disclose the claim, and the IPR is done after one sentence. You're absolutely right, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Virgin. Mr. Foreman?
Thank you. May it please the Court. If a patent owner seeks to narrow a claim scope during an IPR, it may file a motion to amend. Otherwise, it may offer a proposed claim construction and identify any evidence that supports that. Or it may choose both options by offering a proposed claim construction and filing a contingent motion to amend. But what a patent owner can't do...
Why? You're just summarizing your position.
Yeah.
Can you give a reason why the disclaimer shouldn't serve as an alternative way to do an amendment?
Yes, there are a couple reasons. First and foremost, we want claims to be as clear as possible.
The amendment is prospective, right?
Excuse me?
The amendment is prospective.
Correct.
That's a huge difference.
Correct, and it goes into issues on intervening rights and circumventing the motion to amend process, because there are other things besides just proposing an amendment. There are other requirements both in the regulations and in the statute for a motion to amend to be granted. So if you can just walk in to an IPR and say, I disclaim, you know, this coverage, then you don't have to file a motion to amend. You don't have to go through the process of meeting those requirements. And that takes away, and I know there was some discussion of public notice, and while statements during an IPR become public, they are not as public and clearly recognizable as the claim language itself. So if someone from the public wants to understand the scope of...
Neither are prosecution history disclaimers buried in incomprehensible exchanges between the examiner and the applicant.
That's correct.
They're findable, but really?
Well, that's correct, because that prosecution disclaimer is always a situation where you're holding a patentee to a statement they made before the office in a later proceeding. So you don't want to, I mean, in that case, while yes, the disclaimer may be hidden in, you know, thousands of pages of prosecution history, you don't want to allow the patent owner to say one thing to the office and then say something different to a district court down the road. But if we have the choice here, where a patent owner is trying to take advantage of the process to narrow their claims, we'd rather have it done in the claim language itself rather than in a statement made to the board in briefing. I think that's the difference here. So if there are no further questions.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you. Thank all counsel. The case is submitted.
We have to
Oh, I'm sorry. We have a problem. Mr. Andre.
Thank you, Your Honor. Like my last 3 minutes. Just going back to what Your Honor asked earlier, you said a patent owner could just disclaim the prior art and willy-nilly. That's not the case here. We had a prosecution history disclaimer in the original prosecution. We clarified it. So there's a unique circumstance here. Second, I don't think a proper prosecution history disclaimer allows a broad changing of claim scope. It actually narrows it to some degree, but it's not actually having to rewrite the claim. So it's usually done with ambiguous terms, and you argue over it. So it's not taking something out of left field. As John said, there's no rational reason why the PTAB has an interest in finding patents invalid just because there's a prosecution disclaimer as opposed to an amendment. It has the exact same effect.
Why wouldn't it just eliminate the IPR process every time someone could come in and say, well, that thing that's in the prior art, we disclaim that. So you can't rely on that as prior art anymore to invalidate the patent.
Well, I think you can't take it outside the scope of the actual claim language. You can't go in and say black now means white, blue now means red. But in this particular instance, there was a very specific discussion here. As I said, you read the actual claim language.
I mean, I thought disclaimers could be contrary to claim language.
Well, you can't when you're writing the patent original application, but during prosecution, it's just not done in that manner. So what I'm saying is that I don't think it has quite the far-reaching effects that the Patent Office says it would have or Your Honor had articulated. I also want to address very quickly this idea of a subsystem. Once again, the idea of a subsystem is nowhere mentioned in the patent itself. The term doesn't apply. And it still doesn't jive with the fact that you're providing a wake signal to the mobile device. And it doesn't say mobile device processor. It doesn't say that. It says to the mobile device. When it says a communication with the mobile device, it doesn't say mobile device processor. It's the mobile device. And the words do mean something. And so the entire claim read in its entirety, in context, it actually provides a very clear delineation as to what is meant. It says the mobile device having a mobile device processor different than a mobile security system processor. Makes it very clear. So you read the language in context, and there's no way you can read that language and get the board's construction. And the last thing on just very quickly on data ports, every data port disclosed in the prosecution history is an external data port. There's no internal data ports disclosed anywhere in the specification. Unless Your Honor has any further questions, I'll sacrifice my last 20 seconds.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Well, counsel, case is submitted. That concludes our session for this morning.